Hello there, and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. My name is John Caruso. Thanks for listening. Imagine leaving home at the age of 14 to pursue a dream of a life at sea. That's exactly what my next guest did. In this podcast, Andrew Leake and I talk about the exotic locations he visited while with the Merchant Navy. We talk about becoming a salesman for Sanyo, meeting his wife, and we discuss his current role as Flotilla Commander of the Coast Guard in Noosa. I started the podcast by asking Andrew to describe his relationship with the sea and whether respect played an important role in that relationship.
I think you summed it up with one word, is respect. Without understanding the strength, the power of the ocean and waterways, that's where people get into difficulties. And when I went to naval college at the age of 14 in England, I had no understanding of the ocean at all. We built sailing boats and donated them to local charities, and yet we never, ever went out on a vessel of any descript. And I flew to Hong Kong at the age of, on my 15th birthday. And, my 16th birthday. And I flew into Hong Kong Harbour and I saw this beautiful liner. And I said to one of my colleagues, I said, "Wow, is that where we're going?" And they said, "No." It's the rust bucket next door to it. And after it was all fitted, refitted and everything cleaned up in Hong Kong dry docks, we went to sea. And I think the most powerful respect I had was when we were coming home after the first 10 months at sea, was we're going through the Bay of Biscay. Now, the Bay of Biscay is notorious for pretty heavy duty seas. And it was in the month of December. Coming home for Christmas, and we had a mayday call from a fishing trawler. They'd lost a fisherman overboard. So international code tells us that we must search for that person. So we went into a full search and rescue pattern, and we'd been going up and down the waterways where we were advised that approximately where the fisherman had gone overboard, and then a big BP tanker came through, and on communication he took over. He was the senior master of the site, and he asked us how long we'd been searching, and basically we said close to 2 hours now, and he said, "Laddies, go home, enjoy your Christmas. It's a sad time, but you won't find him."
Where did this attraction to the sea come from? So is it, if I get it straight, you grew up, you weren't near the ocean at all?
Not at all.
No.
No, no. The attraction, I think it was a rebellious attraction. My father was in the Royal Engineers. My great uncle was in the Royal Fusiliers, and my grandfather was also in the Royal Engineers. So we sort of had an army background, and I was the rebellious one. And when my father said to me one day, when just after I'd won a scholarship to go to grammar school, he said, "What would you like to do with your life now?" As every father does. Mm. And my answer straight away is, "I want to go to sea."
Because?
I'd been reading stories, like every young boy does at the age of 10, you know, looking at pictures, and in those days, obviously, there was more war stories and battleships and everything, but I didn't want to go down that track of defence services. I went into the Merchant Navy, which I think was the best thing in my life ever.
Yeah.
It was there is an attraction there. You can sit on the boat deck and watch the sun go down. And as I've told my family and all my nephews and nieces and now grandchildren, there's a story on every wave. And as it goes past, you see the beauty of the flying fish. You see the phosphorescence at night time of the wake of the ship. You see the dolphins chasing your bow constantly, and you know, we saw pirate ships, and we travelled the coastal waters of the Vietnamese War, and always I felt safe.
Yeah. Is that what took you to Hong Kong?
Well, it's taken me to more places than Hong Kong. I have actually been very, very blessed with the company that I travelled with was actually the largest, what we called in those days, tramp companies in the world, Andrew Weir and Company, and they were cargo carriers from, if there was a job to be done, they would send a ship there. So we carried anything from timber out of Manila across to Africa, from Africa to Japan. We took copper ingots. We took rice to India. We took grain to India. It was not in containers.
Yeah.
And how the world has evolved as far as shipping is concerned. From ours was just bulk cargo holds to now your containerization. In the electronics navigation side, where I was a navigating officer on board. We went from everything manual using the sextants to know where we were going.
Yeah.
To now, you just press a button and the ship steers the direction for you.
You mentioned all those exotic places around the world, Andrew. Were you a single man at that stage, or were you in a...
Oh, no, I was single.
You said good.
Yeah.
A girl in every port? Is that how...
Well, they say that, but no, that doesn't happen because we have to do cargo watches and we have to keep an eye on the guys that are coming on board, because they in a lot of ports they had a tendency to steal the cargo. We took a full shipload of tea, bulk tea, in big wooden tea chests from Colombo, now Sri Lanka, and went down to Punta Arenas, the tip of South America. And when they started to discharge a certain amount of these tea chests, I noticed while I was on cargo watch, they kept smashing the tea chests on the side of the hatch combing, which is the top part of the hold. And there was guys underneath catching all the tea that was coming down. And it still didn't relate, and I just asked them to be a little bit more careful. When we went ashore for in the evening, they have what they call seamen's missions, where you can go and have a cup of tea and everything and have a drink, you know. And the guy behind the bar said, "Have you got any tea?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, you bought some in." He said, "Do you think you could get us some?" I said, "Yeah." So the next day we got some tea and took it in. And from Punta Arenas right up to Guayaquil in Ecuador, we did not pay for one thing going ashore. We just carried bags of tea with us.
Yeah. I loved your recollection of, you know, these are things that stick in your memory the first time you experience them, the dolphins, the flying fish, the sunsets. Do you have any other memories that are so clear and vivid to you the first time that you went out on a vessel?
The biggest one was our task at hand. We were all on 4-hour watches rotating, so we did two watches a day in the 24-hour system. The way everybody went about it, there was no argument, there was no rules and regulations, you just had to do your job. Because there was, in those days, there was 52 crew that were relying on us to keep them safe.
Yeah.
And as we sailed out of Hong Kong Harbour, going down towards Iloilo in the Philippines, it was so apparent that everything moved like clockwork, and everything was done in what we still term today in a seamanship-like manner.
Yeah.
And that is a common phrase through a lot of the text of today's writings as well. And I think it was that, and the camaraderie.
Yeah.
The closeness of the officers were all there together. Yes, we had a lot of issues, personal issues, particularly the young ones when they came on board.
Like what, missing home?
Missing home.
Family.
Family, absolutely, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and of course, tragedies. I lost my grandfather when I'd left England, and I'd seen my grandfather, and I recall him saying to me, "You're going back to sea, aren't you?" And I just said to him, he was very ill at the time. I said, "Not for too long." And when I got to America, I had a message to go up and see the captain, and he advised me that my father had, grandfather had passed away, and that was a sad time. Because in those days, there weren't the aeroplanes that could get you there so quickly. It was, you know, you were island hopping, basically. And he said, "Do you want to go home?"
Did you return?
And no, I didn't.
Yeah.
No. I did speak to my family, and they said, "No, continue doing what you're doing."
You mentioned pirates earlier, Andrew. Were they ever a real threat to you out on the ocean? Or
no, we were fortunate. That was on the East African coast.
Yeah,
we were always basically under watch or under escort by various military governments: the Australian government, the British government. They were the main bodies. The French came out occasionally, but we were always challenged. What ship were we? Where were we bound? What cargo were we carrying? And a couple of the naval vessels boarded us just to check that we were, using an Australian expression, fair dinkum.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was interesting. And then along the Vietnamese coast, we were watched very, very closely, because of course there was the Vietnamese conflict in those days, and we were just vying between the Asian countries and the African countries, carrying cargo of essential cargoes.
Yeah,
but always challenged, and that was interesting.
What brought you to Australia?
Years after I thought it was time that I needed to get out. I'd achieved the levels of rank that I wanted to achieve. And I was in Melbourne. We were discharging, and I noticed an ad in the paper for an air traffic controller. So while I was in Melbourne, I applied for it.
Yeah.
And we sailed round to Cape Town, and I got a letter saying your application has been accepted.
Right.
Without interview, you know, in those days, upright and breathing, you know, let's take them. And I sailed on through, and we got home on the 22nd of December. And I advised my parents that I was emigrating to Australia.
What did they say?
On the 1st of January. what could they, you know?
I guess you'd been away from home for so long, it didn't really matter. That,
yeah, from the age of 14, basically, and you're just coming home after, you know, terms at sea. So it really didn't make that
And
much
and where
sense.
Were you working? Were you working at Tullamarine with Commercial Airlines?
Well, there's a bit of a story there. By the time I got back to – I flew out and I arrived in Melbourne in January, and contacted the air traffic control personnel, and they said, "Oh, you're too late. We closed all the applications in October." So I missed out on that job.
Now, I'm a bit confused. I thought you were around Cape Town when you said you were accepted.
I got accepted.
But then when you came to Australia?
They said that the intake had been accepted. And
there was no job.
Because we didn't have any communication with them from Cape Town through to England, basically, right. on the return. So then I went into sales and marketing.
Wow.
And I worked, got a job with Sanyo.
Yeah.
In those infant days of, you know, the big tape recorders and boom boxes sure. and everything that we had. And then I was transferred to Tasmania as the state Tasmanian sales manager.
But that life for you, Andrew, must have been like chalk and cheese.
It was.
From you know, the stories that you've told about being at sea for so long, the Merchant Navy, and then I can kind of get the air traffic control thing.
Yep.
And then to do sales for an electronics company.
Yep.
Did you enjoy it?
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. I started off on the road, and so, of course, I was in the backdrops of Australia sort of thing in the outback. So I enjoyed that when I was going between clients and everything. I was still my own independent person and thoroughly enjoyed it. But then,
I guess you had to make it work, didn't you? You were here.
Yeah.
And
I was here and I was on my own.
So is your wife Australian?
Yes, she is.
Yeah, where'd you meet her? And what's her name?
Her name's Kay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did I meet her? Well, I was in a restaurant actually, and I was on my own, and I was running my own business at the time. And this rather vivacious lady came up to me and said, "Would you like to join us?" And I looked up at the table, and there was half a dozen young ladies out for Friday night enjoyment. I had a close look, and I said, "Yeah, of course I will." And I sat right next to my wife-to-be.
Yeah.
And we just clicked.
Yeah.
And 25 years later, we're still...
together.
Still together, yep.
I want to talk about your role with Noosa Coast Guard. Flotilla Commander is your rank?
Yes.
Your rank?
Yes.
This is your commitment to this role. It's a voluntary role. You've done it for how long? It's 24/7.
It is.
You're on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yep.
And how long have you been in that role, Andrew?
In the role of commander, I was elected in June of 2017. I have a 2-year tenure, and then I can re-enroll for the position, and or I can retire. Prior to that, I was the flotilla training officer for 4 years. And that is my actual business background. I ran my own registered training organisation in South Australia and ran that very successfully. So it was a natural movement for me to take my training background and apply it to, and my sea background, and apply them both to assist with Noosa Coast Guard.
And how many volunteers work under you?
We've got 103 in Noosa at the moment.
Men and women?
Men and women.
Yep.
Probably around 30-35% are radio operators.
Yeah.
And we work 24 hours a day on the radio system. So any boaties going out there know that there is that life link between Coast Guard and themselves out in the ocean. Yeah.
Talk about the kind of men and women that become volunteers with the Coast Guard.
I think everybody does have a different purpose when they apply to become a volunteer at Coast Guard. We are very detailed on who we accept. We need people that have got great agility. If they're going onto the boats, they need to have good eyesight. Colour blindness is always an issue because we need to identify red and green and white lights at great distances.
Yeah.
They need to be medically fit. I think each person that comes along feels they want to contribute to their community. Noosa is unique in its own right because we don't have the younger population. The younger population have a tendency to leave Noosa and go to the big cities for work.
Yeah.
Quite understandable.
So are you struggling for volunteers?
I am struggling. I'm struggling for young people.
Yeah. Do you have like a capped number that you, there's an X amount of number of people work or volunteer for the Coast Guard, or is it kind of open?
It is open, but at the same time, I would say that if I was able to gain another 50 people.
Wow.
I would be delighted.
Because it would ease the pressure on the other 103.
It will take the pressure away from the people that are working It's 50 to 70 hours a month as far as volunteers are concerned. Yeah.
And has it ever been stressful for you, Andrew, as the commander and being on call 24/7? I'm sure there may have been moments where you've been socializing with family and friends, or it's an odd or awkward time of the day, or you're traveling. Has it ever impacted on you in that way?
That side of it, no, because my family are hugely supportive of what I do.
Yeah.
Last night I was at a meeting, and they were aware that I was on call. This happens to be my duty week as well as being the commander.
Yeah.
I have to have my phone with me. It goes on vibrate when I'm in those meetings. I just excuse myself. Everybody knows and gives me that support. The difficulties I've had sometimes are the disciplinary difficulties. You don't like to do it, but sometimes it has to be done. And that has caused me some considerable personal heartache. The actual operational side of it, no, I enjoy it. I thrive in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask you your thoughts on this? You often hear it, a boatie or a group of, people have gone out in a vessel and they've been quite foolish because the conditions probably haven't been, the best boating conditions around. You're nodding your head. And then someone like the Coast Guard or emergency or police, whoever, has to put their lives at risk to rescue these guys that have been ignorant of the conditions, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that? Like at putting volunteers' lives on the line? And I'm sure maybe it doesn't come to that point, but there is a degree of risk where you guys have to put your lives at risk to rescue someone else that's done something foolish.
Yes, you're right on the track. We do put our own lives at risk, but we do it voluntarily. If there is a requirement for a crew to go out to assist a vessel, there might be just one person on board, there might be half a dozen on board. The question I will always ask of the skipper going out and of the crew going out, are you comfortable with going out with each other? Do you trust each other?
Mm.
I trust the boats implicitly because they are constantly being serviced. In fact, our primary vessel is now in Mooloolaba at the moment having a total refit at an enormous amount of money that we have to raise ourselves.
Mm.
But those boats are that reliable that we can trust the boats.
I want to talk about funding in a minute.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to make a call to go, we're not going to risk sending anyone out in these particular conditions?
Not sending anybody out. I have been out on a search and rescue 2 years ago now. I took a crew out to north of Double Island Point. We were requested by the water police to assist in the search for the missing trawlermen that were lost north of the island. And we'd been searching for approximately 5 hours. The waters were becoming very uncomfortable, and it's what I call a black sea. You cannot see anything. The waters are just black, and they were quite mountainous. I spoke to my crew, and I said, your call, are you comfortable continuing on, or do you want to return? And they said, we're okay, but you could hear it in their voice. So I just radioed through to the water police and said, I'm calling my vessel out of the search.
Mm.
We were the furthest north. We were in the deepest water. We were in the roughest water. Some of them were searching close to shore. And I made that call. And it was a heartbreaking call to make because you knew that there was somebody, father, brother, son, and you were walking away from it.
Yeah. I imagine making a call like that
would be difficult. That's the call that you don't like to make.
Let's talk about funding.
Coast Guard are funded by the generosity of the Noosa, Tawantin and surround communities.
Yeah. State funding at all? Government, state government, local, no?
No federal government funding whatsoever.
No.
We get a five-year $60,000, and I'll name the figure. So that's just fractionally over $10,000 a year from the state government for the primary purpose of refit for our primary vessel.
Mm.
Now, our primary vessel is in Mooloolaba at the moment, and new engines, complete paint job, new electronics, new seating, all complying with government regulations of meeting OH&S requirements, is costing us $163,000.
For this refurb?
Just for a refurb. It's not a new boat. Yeah. It's a complete refurb.
So what's the shortfall like every year? Like how much then do you have to go to the public and say, help us out? You get just over $10,000 from the state government.
Yep. Per year.
Yeah.
I'm on a shortfall of around $280,000.
Say that again,
$280,000.
Wow.
So our boys go out fundraising.
Yeah.
Noosa Council is very generous.
Yeah.
They support us. We own our own building on their land, and they support us there, and they support us with administration costs. But, of course, it's the generosity of the our sponsors.
That's right.
And, you know, we've got a very, very good community bank that supports us. We've got a resort that supports us, and a very, very large real estate agent.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can name them. That's fine.
Tom Offerman. In real estate, he's very, very generous.
Yeah.
And the Bendigo Bank have contributed greatly over the years. They refurbished our bar tower, complete refurbishment of radio and communication system. But we still have a big shortfall, so our guys have to go out to the Yamundi markets where we sell raffle tickets. We don't worry about getting onions at the bottom or at the top. That's too complex for our guys. But we can sell a raffle ticket. And we do ferry collections as well at prime times, Easter's and Christmas time.
Yeah.
And the general public are very generous. There's always a shortfall at the end of the day as well, but we get through.
Andrew, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing some of your stories and telling us a little bit about your life and the role that you do with Noosa Coast Guard. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Leake was my guest today in Conversations in Noosa. I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, share the podcast about on your social media channels. And if you listen to the podcast via Apple or iTunes or even Stitcher, Wooshka, or even Spotify, don't forget to rate and review the podcast. I'd really appreciate it. Remember, there are fresh podcasts every week on our In Noosa magazine website, innoosamagazine.com.au/conversations. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.